Now, that point in your life, then you're probably, that is connecting you back again with the Panther Valley and
Yeah,
Lansford.
well, like I said, I didn't do it all the time. There was projects I did in the meantime, and we mentioned about the my looking at the photographs of Hiroshima, and the Boston, and how they affected me later on. Well, in the 60s also, well, even in the early 60s too, I was selling a lot of pictures to magazines, photography, modern photography, and I had some in Look and Life and things like. So I was supplementing in my income, supplementing my income with other, freelance work. As long as I was doing it on my own color, my boss didn't care, In fact, he thought it was great, that somebody in his lap could sell a picture to Saturday Evening Post, and get $500 for it. So, when I was talking about the pictures of the bombs, the atomic bomb being dropped, I used to walk along the river, the Lehigh, when the children were little, and we would, as the light would skim across the rocks and all that, they would take on various shapes and forms and things like that. And one day it dawned on me, oh, these are all so real. And after living with them for weekends and years, a couple of years off, they became almost living things to me, these rocks. And I started to collect them and photograph them. And that's how I wrote that story about the after the fire, of how what this earth would look like if everything was demolished and only the images that were frozen on the rocks that if someone came from another planet would see these rocks and say, well, this is what an animal looked like, and this is what a newborn child would look like, and this is what a skull would look like, And I found all these in rocks. In fact, I have them in this case here. Someday we'll have to go through them all. And they, at first, when I showed them in New York City, in the Kodak Center in New York City, I didn't show them after the fire. I just called them rock vases, And I had a nice review in the New York Times. Jacob Deschin gave me two pictures in the New York Times. And
About what date would this be, do you think?
that was in the early 60s too, down here, And then a fellow from Kodak, that had run the thing at the Grand Central Station, the exhibit, they wanted to put it in their Fifth Avenue showroom, so they did it there. And then they were having a big show in the Coliseum in New York, so I had to take them down there again. So I had three showings in New York with these pictures. And then I changed them around. A few years later, maybe about 4 or 5 years later, Cedar Crest wanted some pictures of mine for one of their galleries, and that's when I wrote it after the fire. And then I tied it in with the atomic bomb, and things. And it worked great that way. In the 60s, people were building bomb shelters, and they were afraid. They were afraid that there was all this talk. A lot of it, you look back now, a lot of it was exaggerated and all that, but it was a scare tactic, And I just saw a cartoon the other day, and just about a week or so ago, where some woman said, I think it's time now we could close up the bomb shelter. But if you look back now, I mean, we had this bombing in Oklahoma City. You never know when some idiot or something like that, some foreign country or something, will decide to make a bomb or something like that. Not to obliterate the world like they were promising, some of the pictures are re some of these rock pictures are really. Really scary pictures, I mean, you actually could see like a newborn child, an unborn child on a rock or something like that.
So you're sort of viewing them almost like fossils?
Fossils, yeah. As if As if
this was the imprint of life before the fire.
Uh-huh. In fact, I could read that for you sometimes. Maybe you could put that on tape, you know, that little thing I wrote. Yeah, if who started all this, you know, why did they start it? Why were all these people killed? This is from somebody that came from some other place and saw this. Why did they do this, and what caused it, you know? Is this what the people look like? This is what animals look like. This is what worms look like, you know. And that's what all these rocks are all about. And I guess of all the pictures I've taken, these have probably affected me more emotionally than anything, really, you know. I mean, that affect, you know, more so than, you know, the Amish pictures or the mannequins and things like that. And,
it's interesting to hear you talk, and I'm also sort of aware of, you know, the little piece that you wrote for the Lehigh University Art Gallery catalog. I mean, it seems to me like have you done a fair amount of writing? I mean, it seems like there's a part of you that is a very, you know, is a very creative writer, or that part of what I think has affected you about those photographs is also that you wrote about it, and just the way you tell it now.
I did. Like I said, when they first came out, they came out just plain rock faces and all that, but I knew there was more there to them, you know, just some plain faces. There should be a tie. And then I related back to, you know, this explosion, you know, I called it After the Fire. And it was just putting some words down to some pictures, not that I can write or anything like that. It just, I try to find a reason why I took the pictures, you know, why I felt this way. You know, we could go through some of these pictures sometimes.
I would love to do that. Yeah. You've obviously got a large collection of photos.
My collection of rock pictures along the river, down to Jim Thorpe, Palmerton, and all that, and some of the students, they had some papers at Cedar Crest, and some of the comments, you know, were incredible. You know, their feelings, they felt the same way I did, you know, about the rocks and all that.
And this was sort of the mid or the late 60s by the time that exhibit occurred?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. When I would get in on a project, I would stay, you know, I'd stay on for 1 or 2 years or something like that, or a year, whatever it took, you know, and I would follow it through to completion. When I started the Amish, I was the same way. Every chance I got down to the vacation time, weekends, I would find newspapers with auctions, Amish auctions or something like that. I would go there and I would photograph them. And I had a number of pictures published on the Amish. Grace Hoyer, which is John Updike's mother, I had a series of pictures. She did the story, and I did photographs for traveling camera. And Liberty Magazine, but I always did them with a... I never really poked my camera in their faces, you know, they don't like people photographing them. So I either did it with a long lens, which is kind of sneaky in a way, but, or a hidden camera or something like that. I don't think they minded it so much as long as the camera wasn't exposed and they were exposed to the camera, you know.
So you were less obtrusive there.
Yeah, I was. In fact, John, I forget his last name. He was an Amishman who left the Amish and became an editor of a magazine. And when he saw some of my photographs, he said I did them with, you know, a certain amount of class. So it kind of made me feel good, because you don't want to invade anyone's privacy just to take a photograph. But sometimes you do get the feeling everything is so beautiful and the people are so beautiful with their cost, you know, their clothes and their way of life is so... so different, you know, and when you get into photography, you get the feeling you should do something about it, you know, you should take some And but if you've got to do it with having a certain amount of respect for the people. And I enjoyed the pictures of the Amish.
But this seems like a very interesting period of your life, because you had the security of a regular job,
right,
and yet the independence at times, in a limited way, of a freelance photographer.
Yes, right.
Not as much as if you'd been a full-time freelance, but with the kind of security that you wouldn't have had.
And I was able to use the facilities at the Steel too. If I wanted to make a big print, I have some Amish prints, well, like are 20x24s. You see, well, I couldn't do that at home. I could do it down there, you know, and there's no problem, you see. So, and I was able to, like, use different films and all that. I was just the other day, a fellow brought a picture down in the mines of the old number 8 colliery. He's going back to me, well over 100 years, about 1860s, 1870s. Very faded, you could hardly see it. But by being able to use these various films and learn all this thing, I was able to get a beautiful picture of it.
Do you have a copy of it now?
No.
Let's take a second and look at it. This is Tom Doublin again, back with George Harvin. We've had a little break talking about some photographs of the number 7, the number 8, and the number 9 mines here in the Panther Valley that he had restored. And we're really in the midst of talking about various projects that George has been engaged in. So you were going to tell me about the mannequin project.
Well, that was another project that I started in the 60s. And one weekend I was walking up near the east end of Lansford, up near the railroad station between Lansford and Escalona, near the old stripping area. Fazio's had a stripping area, and then they had a large shed there. It looked like a large garage and all that. I used to pass it every now and then, you know, wonder what was in it. And one Saturday I just happened to open the door and I saw this beat up old car in there, and in the front seat was a mannequin. A woman mannequin. Kind of startled me. I thought, you know, with the way the light was, the backlit and all that, almost looked like a real person, you know, sitting there in the behind of this battered up car. So I opened the door and took some pictures of the, you know, this mannequin sitting in the front seat of this car. And I came home and developed them, and I thought they were, you know, all right. Next week I went back up and the mannequin's gone. So I thought, oh goodness, you know, here I want to take some more pictures and the thing's gone. So I get out and roam around the area, you know, and there I find the mannequin laying in the grass somewhere, and someone had put a hole right through the mannequin's head. A bullet hole through. I guess they're using it for target practice. So I took some pictures there, you know. And this happened every few weeks or some. I'd go back, it would either be changed or something like that, or it was the same place, maybe I would move it or something. It all depends on the lighting and the conditions or something like that. Well, this was the summer, and it just so happened that it went from the summer to the fall, and the rain started to fall on it, and then the plaster started to come off a little bit, and it started to crack, you know. And then it went from, I photographed it from the fall into the winter. The snow was on it, no weeds would fall on top of it, and wherever it fell, I would photograph it, you know. Of course, and all this time it was deteriorating more and more, you know, pieces were falling off here and things like that. And then it went, when it would rain, you could almost see the tears coming down the face, you know, the water flowing down the face. And then after the winter with the cold and all that, and it deteriorated a lot more and it started to really crack, and then it went up into the spring, you know. And by that time it was starting to become less of a mannequin, just the shell of what it was. And then the following summer and all that, it finally, someone had thrown it on the road, and I guess a car ran over it or something like that, and it almost like flattened it out, you know. But that final picture, when it was laying in this puddle of water, it almost looked like the thing was rising, like it was rising in the air. What happened is the reflection of the sky in the water, it almost felt like the mannequin was rising, you know. And it, after I made all these pictures, you know, I made hundreds of them, you know, in the course of the year, the deterioration of the mannequin was almost like the deterioration of a human being. We go through various stages of our life. We're born, we live, you know, we're young and healthy, we're strong and look good, and then we go into our middle stages, the summer of our life, you know, in the middle, and then we get to a certain point, and then we start to go down, you know, the fall and the winter of our lives. And it kind of reminded, put me in fact, the deterioration of this mannequin of our lives ourselves, how we go, where the mannequin did it in one season, well, it will take us maybe, you know, years to do it. But these are the kind of projects that kind of make photography really interesting when you get involved with something like this emotionally.
You're really talking about the human condition.
Yes.
You're not talking about a mannequin.
No, I'm talking about the human condition, how it deteriorates over through the years physically. I'm not talking mentally, naturally. Physically, how we don't look as good 60 as we did when we were 20, that's for sure, you know.
Yeah.
That was another project that took me, like, you know, a little over a year to do. But and I have hundreds of pictures of that. I have printed maybe about 20 that tell each year that I had exhibited, one exhibit or something.
Did a set of that appear as an exhibit somewhere?
No, never. If they ever do this half hour feature on it, I want to include that. You know, and then another project that I worked on for a long time was the Civil War battlefields, like Gettysburg and Antietam and Charlottesville and all that. And I had a Volkswagen camper, and I used to just take off for 2 or 3 days, 4 days, you know, and sleep in there. And I got very involved with the Civil War battlefields, and I would get up early in the morning with no tourists out in the field. And that was another time you would actually feel the battle, you know. If you knew a little bit about how the battles were fought, you could actually hear the guns, and you could hear the cries, and you could hear the horses.
So you did some reading also about the battles.
Oh, sure, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. But that's how you get it's photograph. Taking pictures is just taking photos. You have to get involved emotionally. Other than that, they're just shells. They're nothing, really. And you have to get involved with the... fully involved. Totally involved. In fact, there would be days when I couldn't get any pictures, and I'd feel bad. I would actually feel bad if I would go out somewhere and spend a weekend and never felt I didn't do a good picture. I would actually feel bad. I would. So, the Civil War battlefield pictures, I did a lot of motion where I moved the camera and threw the lens out of focus, and I got grisly... the statues, you know, they have so many monuments like in Gettysburg with different brass monuments and just to photograph them realistically didn't mean anything to me, so I would change them. I would move the camera, I would knock it out of focus a little bit or something like that, and I would make them like death masks and all that, like the people were actually dying, or I'd just take a hand dripping down with, and maybe when it was raining have water dripping off the hand or something, like it almost looked like blood coming out of the fingers, you know. There's a lot of things you could do with a little imagination, you know. You could change things around. You don't have to take point a lens at something and take it the way it is. You have to see a little beyond the surface.
So you have to see that you have to give it your interpretation. You have to give it your make it part of your vision and not just the absolute denotation of what it physically is.
And there was a at that time of my life too, it was, I think you're at your peak of creativity, I think. And it almost seems like you could go anywhere and take an outstanding picture. You could almost feel like you go out and feel the grass and come back with outstanding pictures. But they don't last, it didn't last long, you know. There's only a certain period where it really, never really leaves you. But if you get involved with other outside things that are bothering, you know, that you can't donate all your time to it, you lose it. You lose it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's... Oh, and then I did a series of pictures on about that time on the country auctions in the Dutch country. And that was very interesting. Then I concentrated mostly on faces, the Pennsylvania Dutch. You know, this part of the country has a lot of auctions, you know, farm auctions. And in the 60s and early 70s and all that, there was a lot of farm auctions. And when they would advertise a farm auction, it gave you the opportunity to roam around people's farms, you know, and see their sheds and see their people who were there and who owned it.
So these are, for instance, cases where people are dying and their children really want to run the farm anymore. They have to divide the things among them.
That's right, yeah. And there was so many beautiful farms and so many beautiful people, you know, and all, you know, the older people and the expressions you would get and their dress and the way they reacted to auctions, you know, generally.
Would the people attending the auctions be mostly the Pennsylvania Dutch, or were there a lot of tourists and others who would come in?
There were people
or
looking
antique,
for antiques. Yeah, people
dealers.
Antique dealers. There were collectors. There were people. No, there was a lot of Pennsylvania Dutch. Of course, they had their colorful uniforms, and they spoke. You know, they still speak Pennsylvania Dutch, and. It was kind of interesting listening to them. You couldn't understand them, but you kind of got the flavor of the thing. And then you would tie in the people with outside activities or something like that, or maybe you'd see an old Dutch woman with a young girl or something, you know, or something, you know, how the contrast between the two and all that. And I worked on those for years too, you know, off and on. You don't do this every week, but every now and then you get an opportunity to go to a good farm auction or something. And I used to go down to Kutztown and down around Reading and Virginville, always, you know, different places. So it's kind of interesting too. These are the type of projects that you pick. And you shoot the way you want to, and there's no one telling you how to do it or how not to do it. And that ties in your previous statement. I was able to do a lot of freelance work, and I wasn't really doing this to really sell these pictures or anything like that. I was just doing it for self-satisfaction.
So you would sell some, but it wasn't the reason you did it?
No. In fact, I never really attempted to exploit them or, you know, really...
So that work is primarily all in the 60s?
60s, yeah.
Early 70s?
70s, yeah.